hard-hitting medical truth, cutting through conflict and confusion to the understanding you're searching for. Join Dr. Peter McCullough, world-renowned medical expert and practicing physician, for this edition of the McCullough Report. Your life may depend on it.
Get real, let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. This is the McCullough Report, and this is Dr. Peter McCullough. Welcome to the show this week. It's been a very busy weekend. I had a breakthrough interview on Fox Nation with Tucker Carlson this week. A clip of it aired on primetime on Friday, May 7th, and then it hit the full-length version on Saturday, May 8th. And my phone has been blowing up. My inbox on my emails is full of commentary and reaction. So I wanted to play for you just a few segments of what we went over with Tucker. It wasn't the interview that he was expecting.
About COVID itself. What is this virus? How do you treat it? Dr. Peter McCullough is an internist and cardiologist from Dallas, Texas. He has a long and fairly famed history in medicine, which you can look up if you like, and you should. But more to the point, he has treated COVID a lot, and he knows a lot about it. And so we're grateful to have him with us today. Doctor, thanks so much for coming on. We appreciate
Thanks for having me.
So I just want to be clear at the outset. Here's why you're here. You're here because someone sent me last month videotape of testimony that you gave before the Texas Senate, State Senate HHS Committee on COVID. And you asked a question that I had heard, I don't think anybody ask ever. And it really stuck out. Here it is.
The average person in Texas thinks there's no treatment. They honestly think there's no treatment. They don't even know about these EUA antibodies. You heard from a 90-year-old gentleman who got bamlanivimab. Terrific. Where's the focus? There's such a focus on the vaccine. Where's the focus on people sick right now? This committee ought to know where all these monoclonal antibodies are. They ought to know where all the treatment protocols are. They ought to have a list of the treatment centers in Texas that actually treat patients with COVID-19.
Amazing. Where's the conversation about the treatment of COVID-19? That just, I have a big family. Most members of my family have been infected with COVID-19. Millions of Americans have. I still have never heard a conversation about how it's treated. Why aren't we talking about this?
There's been a global oblivion to the idea of treating patients with COVID-19. And that's everything that that's what Americans want to know. They want to know, doctor, what happens when I get COVID? How do I avoid two bad outcomes? Hospitalization and death. So I looked at this. I gotta tell you, there's two bad.
This makes me laugh when you say that out loud because it's so obvious.
It's so obvious. Patients get sick. They're sick for about 2 weeks at home until they can't breathe anymore, and then they become hospitalized, and almost everybody dies in the hospital. So when I testified in the U.S. Senate, I said, listen, this pandemic response has four pillars. First one is try to control the spread. That's fine. Wear a mask, what have you. Second one is treat the problem and treat it early to avoid hospitalization and death. If people do go in the hospital, treat in the hospital. It's number three. Number four is vaccination. So there's always four-pronged approach. And what frustrated me is in the media cycle, all we heard about was reducing spread from our public health officials, and then later on, vaccination. We never actually heard about treating sick patients.
Before we get to what treatment exists for COVID, and I think there are treatments that some people, including me, even people talk about it every day, aren't really aware of. Before we get to that, what is the answer to the question? Why haven't we discussed this? Why hasn't there been an emphasis on it?
I think there's been an enormous amount of fear. And for the first time in America, doctors and nurses and others were confronted with a disease that they themselves could contract and die from. And I think that fear drove everything. Remember early on in the news cycle, remember Americans learned about a term, PPE?
Yes. Person.
What's that? Does that save a patient? No, that protects the doctors and nurses. We heard a lot about certainly masks and social distancing, what have you. Again, that's protecting well people. That's actually fear driven. Like, oh, we could actually get it. Everything was fear-driven. There were actually a lot of doctors and hospitals that said, listen, you know, we don't treat COVID. If it comes in, we'll play defense and we'll wear our PPE and deal with it in the hospital. So the real revolution was early on in the spring,
I was communicating with colleagues in Milan. I'm an internist and cardiologist, trained epidemiologist. I'm not a virologist, but I handle simple things like asthma, pneumonia, upper respiratory tract infections. And we are communicating with the Italians, and we said, what is going on? And they said, listen, this is like a cold, except the immune system goes crazy in the middle part of it, and then there's blood clotting and thrombosis.
Right.
And so we have to, if we can take...
And that's what can kill you.
Though. That's what kills you. So we take an edge off the viral replication early, we treat the immune system dysregulation, and then we manage the blood clotting, we can get people through the illness. I said, terrific. We got together all of our findings, we published it in the American Journal of Medicine, in August of 2020 issue, the paper went viral. It's still the most downloaded paper in all of American Journal of Medicine regarding COVID. I just got the listing yesterday, it's still number one. And I was never on social media. I was getting inundated with contacts, and my daughter came home from school and said, Daddy, why don't you make a YouTube video? I said, okay, I made a YouTube video. Four slides, I wore a tie. And I can tell you, Tucker, there was nothing wrong about this video. It was simply a straight up, we assembled, we looked for signals of efficacy in the literature, acceptable safety, and put drugs into combination for a regimen. And I four slides, I presented it in 20 minutes, it was up on YouTube, it went viral, and then it was struck down by YouTube.
Well, I think I had Tucker's attention at that time. Why would a four-slide scientific video teaching the world how to treat COVID-19 for the first time and avoid hospitalization and death, how could that be struck down as a violation of the terms of the YouTube community? Let's listen some more.
Incredible suppression of early treatment in the medical literature.
Why would that is so dark? It's hard to believe that it's real, but of all people, you would know. So why would physicians, public health officials, politicians try to suppress information about the treatment of a disease they claim they want to prevent or help America overcome? Why would they do that?
I testified in the U.S. Senate November 19th. We have seen things we cannot imagine in academic medicine. Lancet published a fake paper that came from a fake database that implied that hydroxychloroquine hurt people in the hospital. And we looked at it in 2 seconds. I knew it was a fake paper. They had 70,000 patients in a database that had detailed drug information back in December and going forward. We didn't have that back then. Mean age was 49. We don't hospitalize people at age 49. This went through peer review. It was agreed upon by all the editors. It hung up in Lancet for 2 weeks and scared the bejabbers out of the world by using hydroxychloroquine.
I remember that really well.
And this is the most frequently used, widely relied upon drug in the world. But something's going on.
I'm sorry to back up and pardon my ignorance. I didn't even know this happened. I remember the paper very well because it had political uses at the time because the then president had suggested maybe hydroxychloroquine would be a helpful therapy. And that paper was used to beat him over the head with it. But who would write a fake paper? Who did that? Do we know?
Well, it came from a company called Surgisphere, which rapidly dissolved. The Lancet published a retraction that said, you know, we just couldn't verify the data, and so we're retracting it. No apologies, no explanation of how this could have influenced world events. It greatly influenced the FDA staffers, who wrote an FDA warning, said, well, listen, we think hydroxychloroquine causes harm. Doctors shouldn't use this.
Well, at this point in time, Tucker starts to really get riled up as he understands my message that something is really up in terms of the suppression of early treatment of COVID-19. And here's some comments about therapeutic nihilism.
But you're also describing a society whose biggest institutions are not capable of doing science anymore. I mean, that's the story you just told. Science being, you know, the honest evaluation of reality and the retesting of one's assumption. I mean, that's science, correct?
It's correct. And Tucker, it's worldwide. Something is up. Listen to this. Queensland, Australia, you've probably been there. April, they put on the books as a law. If a doctor attempts to help a patient with COVID-19 with hydroxychloroquine, that doctor will be put in jail for 6 months.
What?
Yes. In April, they put it on the books. Okay.
Why?
Something is up. If you look at the TGA, let's not fry the U.S. agencies. Let's look at the TGA, the FDA equivalent in Australia. And Australia's interesting. They've been kind of spared of COVID-19. They've been in these draconian lockdowns. They have this huge susceptible population. They're all distributed. They've been in fear for 14 months. The TGA has some guidelines for COVID-19. It must have 24 recommendations. Don't use hydroxychloroquine. Don't use ivermectin. Don't use steroids. Don't use anticoagulants. Don't use... They list everything you should not do. It's like, what should you do? Net answer? Nothing.
But, okay. So COVID-19 became known to the West in January of 2020. So that was 1 year and 4 months ago. Okay. So how could, with such a short period of time, the health regulators of Australia know to the point where they codified it in a regulation that hydroxychloroquine is not an effective therapy against COVID-19? Like, how could that be known? It couldn't be known, correct?
It couldn't be known. And in fact, there are pieces of the timeline that are suggesting that something is very wrong going on in the world. And whatever's going on, it is worldwide. It is not just US. Things are worse in Canada. There are anguishing doctors and nurses in northern EU and in Scandinavia about euthanasia and having the seniors literally just be euthanized. There's some horrible things going on.
Okay, you're completely blowing my mind. I didn't expect this interview at all. I saw your testimony. I thought you asked a really interesting question. I wanted to hear more about it. I did not expect this. This is really shocking. And by the way, for viewers who are wondering, who is this guy? Is he just some random guy who's claiming to be a doctor? Look him up. Peter McCullough. And I think you'll be quite satisfied after your Google search that you have the authority to say the things that you're saying.
I testified under oath. I have 600 publications in the peer-reviewed literature. I'm the president of a major medical society. I'm the editor of two major journals. I've headed up 24-day safety monitoring boards in major drug trials and stopped drug trials early for safety reasons. I'm telling you, I have no agenda, but I am deeply concerned that something has gone off the rails in the world. It involves science. It involves the medical literature. It involves a regulatory response. It involves populations kept in fear and in isolation and despair.
So at this point in time, you can imagine Tucker Carlson, who I really thought was a good guy to interview with. I enjoyed my time with him. He is starting to get the idea that what I'm saying makes sense, that in fact there is a suppression of early treatment. There is some type of plan that's being executed in the world to make COVID-19 way worse than it should be in order to pave the way for mass vaccination.
There's the principle of autonomy. This is very important. It's written into the Nuremberg Code. We live by it every day. It says the person, the individual, gets to decide what happens to their body. They can take advice, but what happens to their body without pressure, coercion, or threat of reprisal. This is really important.
Tell us what the Nuremberg Code is.
The Nuremberg Code came out of World War II, where there were atrocities going on. And as we move forward in research, we wanted to learn from this Nazi research, which was awful. We had a terrible situation in the United States, the Tuskegee experiments, where for research, people ought to have informed consent and they can freely participate or not. And we follow that in clinical medicine. This is really, really important. If a Jehovah's Witness says, listen, I'm not taking a blood transfusion. We can't force it into their body. If we have a patient who says, doctor, I'm not taking a vaccine. We cannot, without pressure, coercion, or reprisal, we can't have somebody say, listen, I'm going to lose my job. That's pretty strong coercion, don't you think?
Yeah, you can't make a living. You can't eat. Yeah, that's about the strongest possible. I mean, short of physical harm. That's
how about I can't go to school? I can't get my college degree.
Your children can't be educated if you don't obey? So that's, I think that's a point that all decent people have considered at some point in the last week or two, as we're learning that coercion is real and that you will be punished unless you obey. My question to you, though, as a physician, is that is in direct contradiction of the Nuremberg Code. Is that something that all physicians are familiar with?
Yes.
So... why are they standing back and allowing this to happen?
The groups think is extraordinary. You know, there's some doctors that have told patients, I'm not going to see these patients unless they're vaccinated. They can't go into my waiting room unless they're vaccinated. You know, there's a hospital in Texas, in Houston, Texas, that came out and said, listen, if people don't succumb and take the vaccine, that for months, they said, listen, in order to encourage you, we'll pay you $500. If I tried to do that in a research study, the Investigational Review Board wouldn't agree with that. That's coercion. $500 is coercion to low-income workers. But it still didn't convince them. The workers were, you know, looking at the safety and saying, I think I'm going to hold back. Then they came out a week or so ago and said, listen, if you don't take the vaccine, we're going to fire you. And then the workers got together and said, some of us don't want it, can't take it. And they said, you're fired. And some employees started getting fired.
Well, at this point in time, we've made great progress, actually, on getting an understanding out for America about what's happening. Suppression of early treatment, now coercion into vaccination against the will of an individual with consequences, and people started losing their jobs. So I think Tucker Carlson actually did a wonderful job in getting out the issues for America to consider. Many in our supporting groups on early treatment and appropriate vaccination felt that this interview could have been a real change, an inflection point in the history of the crisis response. One of the big issues we tackled promoting vaccine hesitancy or without overstating the data, one of the things we did get out was the issue of who was excluded from the randomized trials of vaccination and why we would never consider an investigational vaccine administered to a patient where we had no efficacy data or no safety data. Why we would never do that. Listen to this.
I think it's interesting that people who work at a hospital wouldn't want the vaccine. I mean, these aren't people who work at a Goodyear plant. I mean, these are people who work around medicine. I mean, that's what they do for a living. They're around medicine. They're also around COVID. They have a much higher chance of getting infected with it if you work in a hospital.
Well, listen,
But they still don't want it.
No, but they know the clinical trials. This is very important because we participate in the clinical trials. The FDA, Pfizer, Moderna, J&J, AstraZeneca, strictly excluded, COVID recovered, suspected COVID recovered, those with antibodies, pregnant women, women of childbearing potential who couldn't assure contraception. That is a huge group of exclusions. That's a giant part of the healthcare workforce. So of course they looked at that.
That's a giant chunk of America.
So Tucker, if they weren't eligible for the randomized trials and said, you know what, the FDA and the sponsors thought maybe there was a problem with safety or they had no chance of benefit and only a small chance of these safety events exclude them, why would they electively go into an investigational program now?
So I don't think most Americans are even aware of that. I mean, the fact that pregnant women were excluded from the safety trials, I think, is fairly widely known. I think it's less known that COVID recovered, and that, I don't know how many tens of millions of Americans fall into that category, but certainly tens of millions have had COVID, whether they knew it or not, and recovered from it. They were excluded from the trials. Why? On what grounds?
Well, very good grounds. COVID recovered patients so far are racking up a terrific track record of freedom from reinfection. It's nearly airtight. Think about SARS-CoV-1 is 80% homologous to SARS-CoV-1 and 2 are 80% the same. The first SARS pandemic, people had durable and complete immunity, 17 years so far. You don't get it twice. We've had 111 million people in the world who've gotten this infection. If there was a chance for double and triple infections in the same person, we would have seen it by the millions, millions. If you look in the literature, maybe you can find 100 cases where someone says, I think they got reinfected. And we look, and almost always it's a misinterpretation of one of these PCR tests, which is commonly false positive.
Yes.
And then someone sick over here, the most recent one from France, it was a misinterpretation. One of the false narratives out there is you can get the infection twice. It's a false narrative. And the FDA...
Why would people say that?
Well, listen, the FDA and the sponsors knew that. Of course they excluded COVID-recovered patients. They know you can't get it again. They're not going to have them in a clinical trial and have the clinical trial go to the null. They knew that. But when it came out, I think in an air of caution, this would be the innocent explanation, an air of caution, they said, we'll make it available to everybody. But quickly, making it available to everybody started to become a coercive thing. So now people are saying, listen, I'm COVID recovered, I'm pregnant, I was never even tested in the study. Is this safe? Remember, in pregnant women, the only thing we allow is the inactivated flu shot and the tetanus, diphtheria, and pertussis, which is inactive. We never let anything pathogenic into a woman's body who's pregnant, never. When we give the vaccine, all the forms of the vaccine produce the viral spike protein. They produce one type, by the way, the Wuhan original type, which, by the way, is long gone in the United States. We got 14 strains right now. Wuhan original is not one of them. But you produce that in a high quantity in the body. That is directly pathogenic. It causes blood clotting. It damages the blood vessels, causes fever. So we are actually having women's bodies produce a pathogenic protein for a few days.
And we don't do that with any other vaccine.
Never.
You can see at this point in time, we've covered a lot of ground, and I think there's great alarm of what's going on with the mass vaccination program. And to wrap up, I have to tell you, I think it was a breakthrough interview. I was satisfied at the time. It was explosive, but I thought I had all my talking points out, and I thoroughly enjoyed my time with Tucker Carlson. My impression of him is very, very positive as a person in media who really cares about the country. And I wanted to share these important segments with you. In this week's program, we have two important guests, both distinguished scientists. We have Dr. David Scheim, who is going to give us an update on ivermectin as a treatment for early outpatient COVID-19. And then we have Andy Bostom, formerly of the Framingham Heart Study, who will go into great detail about the COVID-19 epidemic, real cases, testing, and the implications as we move forward. So let's sit back and enjoy this issue of the McCullough Report. Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. This is the McCullough Report.
Is a record player the best way to listen to music? Of course not. So why are you still taking vitamins that haven't been upgraded since the 1930s? Even if your vitamins aren't hard to swallow, it's time to upgrade to Healthy Cells pill-free, patent-pending microgel supplements that work at the cellular level to boost immune health, sleep better, focus deeper, and stay younger longer. They taste great, convenient on the go, and they're more natural too, without chemical binders, fillers, and coatings. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order of any product. That's HealthyCell.com, HealthyCell, and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
It was a vision that gave birth to a unique multimedia platform that would combine classic talk radio, great writers, and memorable podcasts and videos. AmericaOutLoud.com is a conservative leader in a field that is predominantly run by far-left progressive globalists. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. This is the McCullough Report. I'm Dr. Peter McCullough, and it's my great pleasure to invite to the show Dr. David Scheim. Dr. Scheim attended the University of Rochester in Rochester, New York for his undergraduate degree, and then went on to the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and received his PhD in mathematics. He was a senior scientist at the National Institutes of Health Division of Eye Disorders for many years. He's had a great interest in mathematical modeling of a variety of diseases, not only ocular diseases, but cancer. And David's been a real hero in the emerging crisis of COVID-19 and helping us understand what we call ecological data. That is, what are other countries doing in terms of the pattern of disease and treatment response? David, welcome to the McCullough Report.
Great to be with you, Peter.
Okay, let's set the stage. The listeners are probably familiar with some of the drugs that are used worldwide to treat COVID-19. One of the features drug is ivermectin. David, can you just say a few words about, for our audience, what is ivermectin?
Well, let me just start off by saying the Nobel Prize Committee awarded only one prize since 1952 for the treatment of an infectious disease, and that was for ivermectin, which won the prize in 2015. And by the way, the Nobel Prize winner, who was very skeptical and obviously cautious of the data initially of ivermectin for COVID-19, he did an extensive review of the data, and he found conclusively that ivermectin is effective. So this is a major drug. And so it just so happens that this drug, the molecular fit, it appears to bind to the viral spike protein, the thing that we all talk about with the vaccines. And it gets in the way. It basically defangs the virus. So it appears to turn COVID into essentially a common cold. It cuts mortality in the randomized clinical trials by a pooled 78%. But for the higher doses, when used optimally, it looks like greater than 90%.
So, David, you've, over the course of your career, you've looked at a lot of treatment data sets, I'm sure, and always try to, you know, what we're trying to do in science is we're trying to figure out, does a drug really work or not? And the public may be frustrated with us and have a sense that, boy, the doctors are you know, seem to go back and forth on a variety of treatments. You may hear in my field, does aspirin work? Some studies say, well, aspirin works. Other studies say it doesn't. And we go back and forth. Is there any question in your mind about ivermectin working in COVID-19?
None whatsoever. I mean, we see it in the randomized clinical trials, 78% mortality reduction. We see it in the experience of so many doctors, many prominent doctors, some who have used it on themselves, some who have used it on their close relatives. And the thing that, you know, this remains to be published, and I think this will be coming out in a month or two, it's not just statistical. It's not that you have some group of patients and they do much better mortality-wise than controls. It's that the effects are immediate. People take them, they're sick, they're in a breathing crisis, they're on oxygen, they take ivermectin, in within half day to a day, they're off the oxygen and fine. This happens again and again and again. Unfortunately, the science, there's no structured paper yet that is reporting that, but this will be coming out pretty soon. It's not just that it's statistical, it's that the effects are immediate. I just know from close friends who have had this. You hear doctors, you see it in the studies. There's no question that this works.
Well, today, there's always news every day in the world. Today it was announced that the Philippine government went ahead through special permit process there across all the islands of the Philippines to get ivermectin out to all the hospitals to treat patients with COVID-19. But you have some specific inside knowledge or certainly great expertise in what's happened in two countries, Peru and Zimbabwe. Can you give the audience an update there?
Sure. Let me start with Peru. I first saw some brilliant analysis by Juan Chamey, who went to university in Colombia and is really familiar with the Latin American, the way things were done there, and dug deep. And the data is all from the National Health Ministry, all public data. He did a great analysis. And it just showed basically very strong indications that ivermectin was working during the period when it was used. So I went in and helped and just critically analyzed all of this and made sure there wasn't some loophole. And basically, during the period ivermectin was used through November, deaths went down 14-fold. And then a new president came in sort of dominated by major drug company interests, and they decided to marginalize ivermectin. Deaths over the next 2 months, deaths went up 13-fold. And now the thing is, you have state-by-state data. Different states used ivermectin to different degrees at different times. You can do very good statistical analyses based on these distinctions between the 25 states, and you find conclusive statistical significance. You find that the states that used ivermectin most intensively starting at a given time period, the deaths dropped right after the ivermectin distributions began. So we have conclusive data for Peru, and that's a country of 33 million people. So that's that. And then for Zimbabwe, it's not as, we don't have this kind of conclusive massive statistical support, but we do know that a bunch of doctors learned about ivermectin in starting really in December, but they started doing mass treatments in January. Deaths were up to 40 per day. A month later, after mass nationwide use, they were down to zero. And the doctors there are reporting the same pattern of dramatic, immediate resolution of symptoms.
So it's really encouraging news. I know clinically, leading a group of doctors, when we put our first set of treatment recommendations out to the world, we had submitted our paper in July, and we just didn't think as of July 1st, when we submitted it, we had enough data. But clearly over the next few months, all the trials weighed in, the observational studies, and our update guidance that was published in December 2020 in Reviews in Cardiovascular Medicine, 57 authors, strong consensus. Ivermectin clearly has a role in the early outpatient treatment of COVID-19. And not only that, of all the outpatient drugs we use, it has great inpatient data. So in the fear and confusion of COVID-19, certainly within the United States and outside the United States, some patients have been caught in the middle. And some of you may be aware of some bellwether cases in New York State where an attorney, Laura Goh, has had to go with families to get court orders to have the doctors administer patients ivermectin. So I think with the fear and confusion and all the terrible things that's happened with COVID-19, some doctors and hospital administrators have really gone in the wrong direction here. Here's a drug, in my view, that's safe. It's effective. We use it for scabies and other conditions. The listeners may recognize it. We use it in our dogs to treat various parasitic infections. And it falls in the category of almost certainly it works. It has a wonderful safety profile. I think the only residual questions are, you know, what's the optimal dose and how many doses do we need to give? And honestly, as a doctor who's prescribed this, and I have great experience in prescribing it, it really doesn't matter. We can follow people clinically and whether it's 3 days or 5 days or longer. Dr. Shyam, do you have any final words for our audience today?
Were to get COVID, do your very best to get a hold of some ivermectin and take it at a good dose. You can go to some good websites like the FLCCC has guidance, but it's very safe at much higher than standard doses. And I'd say just, you know, you use enough, look it up, and it's extremely effective.
I'd say one last practical point for American listeners. There is a free telemedicine service that operates just on charity donations. We featured it on the show in the past. It's called myfreedoctor.com. And they do have established protocols, treatment protocols that use ivermectin. And they actually have a prophylactic protocol where ivermectin is given periodically to prevent the development of severe COVID-19. So you can go to myfreedoctor.com and enter your information, and then you'll engage in a communication with a doctor. And the patients come in to that system either because they want prophylaxis or they're interested in active treatment of COVID-19. You've been listening to the McCullough Report, Dr. Peter McCullough and Dr. David Shyam, formerly at the National Institutes of Health. Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. You're listening to the McCullough Report. Me on the show today is Dr. Andy Bostom. Dr. Bostom received his bachelor's degree from State University of New York, downstate, and then also went to SUNY downstate for medical school. He received a master's degree from Brown University, did his internal medicine residency at Brown University, and then he was fortunate enough to get a very prestigious fellowship in clinical epidemiology at the Framingham Heart Center, which is considered the most famous cardiovascular epidemiologic study of all time. He additionally has an advanced degree in nutritional science from Tufts University. And Dr. Bostrom has really been a leader, an intellectual leader, helping doctors in the field manage COVID-19, treat patients for COVID-19. And he's been very helpful in assisting us in what the Centers for Disease Control is really asking clinical doctors to do, and that is to weigh out the risks and the benefits of the SARS-CoV-2 COVID-19 emergency use authorized vaccine. This vaccine in the consent form is indicated that it's investigational, which it is. It indicates that it's purely elective to take the vaccine. And so in the consent form in multiple places as well on the CDC website, patients are asked to consult with your doctor. And so I've asked Dr. Bostrom to come on and help us work our way through this weighing out the risks and the benefits. Dr. Bostrom, welcome to the McCullough Report.
Thanks, thanks, Peter. It's a pleasure to be with you. I just one caveat. I'm relying, since I'm no longer in clinical practice, my attention is really focused on dealing with the medical literature and with the turmoil in terms of regulatory agencies, whether they're my local agency in the state or CDC. So I just wanted to make that clear. But I think this issue of reinstallment of the J&J vaccine really captures a lot of the problems that clinicians are confronting. Because as I'm sure your listeners understand now, that there was this moratorium, a pause placed on the vaccine because of cases of this. And it was really sort of monomaniacal attention on this, Peter, which I think is also an interesting phenomenon about these dramatic cases of thromboses, clots in the circulation of the brain itself, leading to some catastrophic outcomes, death and severe disability. And I think that was the focus, and to a certain extent, obviously that's understandable. But we have this recording system for the whole gamut of adverse events called the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, which is also run by the CDC. And in the course of the presentation that basically reinstated the J&J vaccine, they broke down for you what they thought, and this was purely, again, these infamous models that we've been living with. They actually modeled what they thought would the number of deaths that would be prevented by reinstating the vaccine program, certainly with the J&J vaccine. I think the models themselves are pretty dubious, but regardless, one of the things that really struck me was that in the age group from 18 to 49, combining men and women, their models projected going forward that 44 deaths would be prevented. And again, I think this may be an overestimation, but regardless, just looking in that age group, that age stratum, for what we have recorded, not speculated, but recorded, there have been 21 deaths that are quote unquote vaccine associated through their own monitoring system. Now, what was striking was that there was no mention of that whatsoever. And then you have a trade-off that even if we believe these models, you're going to get half the number of deaths that are not related to COVID occurring in people who get vaccinated. I've never seen such a trade-off. It obviously changes dramatically when you get above 50, and I think reasonable people would accept that maybe the vaccine should be reinstated and target people above 50. But this idea that somehow it should be reinstated in people less than 50 was absolutely striking to me. And another piece of data that I think is important to understand comes from the UK experience with a similar adenovirus vector platform vaccine, the AstraZeneca vaccine. There, Peter, again, this is all based on modeling, but there, the Public Health England found that in their model, to some extent correlated with clinical experience with the vaccine, they projected that in the 60 and above age group, 10,400 COVID deaths may have been prevented. However, Peter, even in that stratum, even in that group, by the time you get down to 60 to 69, only 100 deaths, according to PH Public Health England, may have been prevented. So 99% of the benefit was accruing in people that were 70 plus. They didn't even bother to speculate about what they might have quote unquote prevented in people less than 60. And yet we are reinstating, you know, a vaccine based on the same similar platform in a group where, you know, it's very hard to determine any particular benefit of the vaccine. I'm unfamiliar with anything like this. Going back to the experience with Guillain-Barré and the 1976 swine flu, there were 40 million injections at the time of roughly at the time of the moratorium. This is the classic Langmuir paper. There were 500 cases of Guillain-Barré, which Langmuir's analysis, I think, really showed were definitely related to the vaccine program. And there were 25 deaths. So that's a case fatality ratio of 5%. What we're seeing now with the adenovirus vector vaccines, whether it's Janssen or in the United States or perhaps even worse, AstraZeneca overseas, is a much higher case fatality rate from a more serious syndrome, albeit rare, that's developing. I mean, applying the 1976 standard, both of these vaccines, you know, would have been on moratorium on the basis of this documented. And by the way, the CDC or the FDA, I'm sorry, the FDA letter to Janssen last Friday is specific about saying that there's a causal association now to these rare cases of cerebral venous thrombosis and low platelets. And as you pointed out to me off air, there are other vascular beds that are being affected by this, venous systems that are being affected by this. So the scope of the problem is only growing.
Well, the listener should appreciate that the adenoviral vector platforms, AstraZeneca and J&J, even, you know, 10 years ago, had some association with thrombosis, just the vector itself. But now that we have a vaccine that produces the spike protein is directly thrombogenic. Even patients who develop the natural infection, a huge risk is blood clotting. That's the reason why we treat patients with blood thinners. So we know broadly now that this rare blood clotting problem with the vaccines, that the regulatory agencies have said, listen, the vaccines cause it. And in fact, it can be deadly, but it's rare. In my view, that's been a bit of a distraction or a smokescreen for the much larger number of deaths, thousands of deaths due to the acute reactions to the vaccine, was called reactogenic deaths, and then a smaller group that die immediately in the vaccination center of anaphylactic death. But we are at 3612 deaths in the United States, far beyond the typical 25 that would be ever considered reasonable in terms of a trade-off. There's over 7,000 deaths in Europe. And so we're running a gauntlet here of death with the vaccine versus trying to get the pandemic under control. So how do we factor this together, Dr. Bostrom, in terms of efficacy? Is the vaccine really, is this gamble really going to work?
Yeah, I think to me, it's clear. And again, you know, I'm a non-clinician, but I still, you know, can look at the data and can look at the angst of my clinical colleagues. I would not recommend any of these vaccines to people certainly less than 50, unless they fit a niche profile. You know, if they're high risk, if, you know, even a young kid that's weathered the storms of cystic fibrosis and is now in college, there, the benefit, you know, likely could outweigh the risk. But by the time when you get below 50, you're looking at niches of people that have a unique, whether it's immunodeficiency or lung disease or developmental disease, have a unique risk for complications from COVID. whereas the vast preponderance of people under 50 are at extremely low risk, mercifully, from COVID. And there, I think that the trade-off, to me at least, has become pretty clear, is don't vaccinate them. And then there's the other issue. Again, I mentioned this, Peter, before we came on. There's a huge cohort study from Israel now, Vaccine Central, of almost 6.4 million people, showing that naturally acquired immunity, people that are convalescent from COVID-19, are at least as well protected from recurrent infection, and certainly the morbidity and mortality associated with recurrent infection, as those that were vaccinated in Israel, the sort of center of COVID vaccination, protocols. And they are advising, the end of the preprint, Peter, literally says that these data question seriously the validity of vaccinating people who've been infected.
Well, keep in mind, the FDA, Pfizer, Moderna, J&J, AstraZeneca, they had an idea that the vaccine would never help COVID-recovered patients, because COVID-recovered patients have such complete and durable immunity similar to SARS-CoV-1. So COVID-recovered patients were strictly excluded from the clinical trials. So it was really off the rails to ever vaccinate them to begin with. And now Methodius has published from Manchester, United Kingdom, that 26% of patients vaccinated there needlessly had COVID-19, and they had a 56% excess rate of adverse reactions and hospitalization. So to this day, there hasn't been a single study demonstrating any benefit of vaccinated COVID-recovered patients. And there isn't a single study showing that vaccine-related immunity, which only has a partial protective effect, can match up to the natural immunity.
Well, so I know there was great disappointment at one analysis that I saw of elderly patients in the UK again with the AstraZeneca vaccine, is that, and these were, I believe, 70 plus and 80 plus. Maybe it was just the 80 plus cadre that they were, and where again the highest risk is. They were very disappointed that only 12% of them showed evidence of T cell immunity after they were fully vaccinated with the AstraZeneca vaccine, and that was a significant disappointment to them.
Well, there's been some preclinical studies which are very dramatic. Keep in mind that the current vaccines only code for the spike protein. That's the only, in a sense, antigen the body is asked to produce with the vaccines. And they're all coded to the Wuhan wild type spike protein. Now, in the United States, the CDC reported we're currently at 14 different strains of virus. The strains are largely determined by mutations in the spike protein. The Wuhan original strain is long gone. So Americans are being vaccinated for a strain that's long gone. And the hope is that the vaccine gives enough protection against the 14 other strains that you're not vaccinated for. And a lot of Americans don't know this. The CDC has not been forthcoming with these data, even though they publish it on their website. They haven't been forthcoming. And then none of the agencies have been forthcoming on safety. So the listeners are strongly encouraged to go to openvaers.com and get the weekly update so you can see the safety events. I think we're currently at 3612 deaths and over 30,000 hospitalizations, ER visits, and urgent office visits as a consequence of the vaccination program. So Andy, let me ask you a question. If I have a patient who is 65 years old, who works as a doctor in an office and has not had COVID-19, but let's say has hypertension and has some stable atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, for that patient, how do you weigh out the risks and benefits of taking the COVID vaccine, and which one would you think would be optimal?
I hope this doesn't sound too nihilistic. I would argue that perhaps this person, if they're clinically stable, Peter, as a clinician, I mean, have you found this at all helpful in helping in making this decision? Would this particular person have had a history or recent history of a severe illness with influenza? because is that a surrogate that we can potentially use? Because I'm beginning to see that there was a very interesting study reported out of the Rockefeller University. They were at least the coordinating site, and there are about, oh gosh, I think it's in the range of 2% or so of the population that has these polymorphisms that reflect an inability to mount a good interferon response, and this has predicted severe. It's a very small percentage, obviously, of the hospitalizations, but homozygotes for this mutation are much higher risk for severe COVID hospitalizations, and some of them historically, when they were queried, acknowledged that they had bad experiences with the flu, not actually worse experiences with COVID, but bad experiences, hospitalizations or near hospitalizations with the flu. So it's, I don't want to hedge on this, but given what we're seeing now with this vaccine, which has way more complications than the flu vaccination, is that even in a patient like you're describing, we do have treatments. I mean, you're the world expert on using things like ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine. God forbid this person got sick and you manage them early. And then we have monoclonal antibody cocktails. That's a tough one. I mean, it's certainly not like to me what's become a no-brainer is a healthy person under 50 just don't vaccinate them. It is a more difficult decision, but I think it's got to be nuanced even in the case that you're describing now. If this is a clinically stable guy whose coronary artery disease is well managed, the other thing is, Peter, are they having a high risk exposure? Are they still doing a lot of ICU work where they might be dealing with heavy viral load, COVID patients in the hospital? I think a lot more has to be weighed now. Whereas in the past, if it was something like, a flu vaccine, because the risk profile of the vaccine appears to be so much more benign, you would just say, sure, vaccinate him. It's a more difficult call.
Right. Remember, the vaccine is always to protect the individual. It's never to protect the population. So you're right. Flu vax, we'd say, listen, generally, it's in your best interest to take it. But if you want to, have an exemption, that's fine. I would tend to think that type of physician, as an example, if they're in a high contact situation, clearly if they're doing rounds at a nursing home, things right. like this, that they should be vaccinated. Right. I have a whole list of patients tomorrow in the office. I'm thinking about my very first patient who has lung disease. They have heart failure. They have an ICD in, has sarcoidosis, renal failure. And I have to tell you, I think if that patient got COVID, I don't think she'd last a day or two.
Right. That's a different scenario than someone perhaps with stable coronary artery disease. But I'm just saying these calls are becoming increasingly difficult the more we learn about the vaccine.
Right. So my point is for her, I'll explain to her, listen, these rare things can happen with the vaccine. But boy, if you got COVID, I don't think we could stop it. It could be fatal for you. But I can tell you, if I looking at college kids, now that there are 80 colleges that say vaccinate all the kids, there are employers now saying to vaccinate their employee populations with a voluntary federal program that's investigational. That is a giant overreach. There are civil liberty lawyers that are sharpening their knives. Keep in mind that when one signs consent for the vaccine, they indemnify the vaccine manufacturers and the administration center, but they don't indemnify the person that's forcing them to get a vaccine. Exactly. And the EEOC has already ruled that if an employer demands a COVID-19 vaccine and there is an injury, that's considered a work-related injury. So the employer's on the full hook. So as the deaths roll in and they're coming in at a high enough rate, they'll end up being work-related deaths and work-related hospitalizations. And I think the liability that employers are going to take on is sky high. And did you have any final words for the audience?
Yeah, I just really did want to comment on the issue of college students. I think, as we say in Yiddish, it's a shanda. It's a terrible disgrace that this would be forced upon them. Peter, I actually was asked at the time when Scott Atlas was Dr. Atlas was an advisor to the Trump administration to review what I could open source on what was going on the college campuses from August to the Thanksgiving break. I was able to identify 140,000 positive tests at 100 major universities in the United States for that summer fall semester. Out of that 140,000, again, relying upon open sources and because of the ghoulish nature of our press, you know, I don't think I missed it very many, there were only 17 hospitalizations that I could identify. And most of them were for rehydration. There were a couple of serious hospitalizations, obese asthmatic kids that wound up in the ICU. But out of 140,000 positive tests from that whole period, there were 17 hospitalizations. And the campuses that are demanding this will not give you the data when they're requested on, okay, you must have a problem here at Notre Dame. How many of your kids have been hospitalized with a COVID pneumonia? Not hospitalized because they went to a campus frat party and required hydration after alcohol and bowl, by the way, tested positive. Admission with a COVID pneumonia. You can't get that information from the 78, 80 colleges that are demanding that their kids get vaccinated. This is unacceptable.
I'm aware of one NYU college student that I advised on that tragically she didn't receive any early treatment, even though she presented with severe symptoms. She was hospitalized, not intubated, just was treated with corticosteroids and oxygen was released, and she's had a post-COVID syndrome. But suffice it to say, there were no major college outbreaks, no clear signal of risks of hospitalization and death in college students. The robust immunity that they get from the natural infection is quite rewarding. And many right now are strongly opposing mass vaccination with the investigational vaccine in college age children, specifically for the reasons of unacceptable safety and imperceptible benefit. And I'm hoping cooler heads prevail. I think that college administrators are trying to respond to a variety of pressures. There may be actually more fear in faculty members and other adult workers on campus. And that's really, again, their concern. And if that fear drives a decision, I think I've had patients say, listen, doc, I'm going to take the vaccine. I'm just scared to death of COVID. And it's a fear-based decision. If they want to do that, that's fine. If there is a college student who, you know, wants to elect into the program, I think that's perfectly fine. But the principle of autonomy being that we all control our own bodies and we can take advice, but we can never be pressured, coerced, or have the threat of reprisal for something injected into our body, we must preserve. I've been talking with Dr. Andy Basta. Andy, welcome, and thank you so much to your contribution to the McCullough Report. Let's get real, let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio.